As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome
to Plotting Through the Presidents,
where Howard takes an irreverent dive into lesser-known stories of the founding fathers, their relatives, and their friends.
That's me. I'm Howard. And where Jess is not privy to what I'm going to talk about ahead of time, so reacts in real time like a normal human.
That's right. I am reacting along with you.
This is our final episode in a three-part series on George Washington's home, Mount Vernon. But you don't need to listen to the first two to follow along because this episode is self-contained.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Our previous episodes focused on the efforts of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association to purchase the mansion in the 1850s, to save it from ruin, and then to preserve George Washington's view as far as the eye can see from his back porch, looking over the Potomac and beyond.
It seemed like a lifelong journey, too, to protect those things.
Yes, to protect everything the light
touches. Lots of drama, yeah.
In this episode, we're going to a part of Mount Vernon that the light never touches.
Ooh, the shadows?
The cellar.
Ooh, the cellar of Mount Vernon.
Yes.
Deep down into its belly.
Yes, the underbelly.
The underbelly of Mount Vernon.
That's right. This is a story in two acts. Act one is the cornerstone. We visited Mount Vernon in 2016, you and I. And when it came time to book a tour, I chose the National Treasure Tour because it was the only tour that took you into the cellar. And how could I say no to that? You know how I love underbellies.
Yes. Wet, dank places.
Yes.
That's your cup of tea.
It's my cup of tea.
Mine too.
Yeah.
Which is why I trust you to book the tours.
Our guide there, she was very friendly, knowledgeable, a woman named Karen. One of the things that stuck with me on that tour was something that Karen showed us in that cellar, a stone that was set into the wall of the cellar. It used to be known as the cornerstone. That stone, or plaque, whatever you want to call it, has a key role in National Treasure 2 and in a Mount Vernon mystery that we'll get to soon. But first, I want to talk about what this stone is and what it represents.
Do it.
So it's set into the wall. It's like 2 feet wide, a little more than a foot tall. It's this big kind of stone plaque-looking thing. It's got like this crude coat of arms carved into it with a little heart in the middle and then two crossed halberds.
What are halberds?
Good question that I also had to look up. A halberd is a long spear with an axe head, or think of it like a long battle axe with a sharp point at the end. It's like a two-in-one.
Okay.
Yeah. It's handy if you only have room for one tool and you need to like stab something and then slice it.
Okay.
Yeah. But the part of the stone that's most important for this story is the two letters engraved on it, the initials LW.
Huh.
So here's a picture of this stone.
Oh, almost like L loves W, like with the heart in the middle.
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
What do you think W could stand for Washington?
Yeah, that's the most likely story.
But what's L?
That's a great question. We're going to talk about that. So the stone that we saw in the basement is actually a replica of the real cornerstone. The real thing is in a museum there, and it was moved because it was deteriorating in that damp cellar. But the real stone wasn't always in that cellar. That's not where it started out.
Okay. So it has an origin story.
It does.
Okay.
Like everything.
Like everybody.
What it is, we're not exactly sure. but they're pretty sure.
Oh, I thought you were sure.
There's some mysteries in this episode that may not be fully solved.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll forgive.
Okay, thank you. I'll forget. They're pretty sure this stone was put there by George Washington when he was having the basement walls constructed there, mm-hmm. reconstructed in the 1770s. But it's not that the stone is a lot older than that. It's really the oldest part of the existing Mount Vernon mansion.
Hmm.
And one of Mount Vernon's oldest mysteries is, who is L.W.?
Who is? Yeah.
For a long time, people thought L.W. referred to George's half-brother, Lawrence Washington,
mm-hmm.
because he owned Mount Vernon before George.
That's right.
Just made sense.
That totally makes sense.
Yes.
Problem solved.
There we go. And Lawrence was 14 years older than George. He was in the British Navy. He actually inspired George to go into the military. He had a big part to do with George's life. And Lawrence is the one who actually gave the estate the name Mount Vernon.
Wow. So it's got to be him.
Before then, it was called Little Hunting Creek.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's precious.
Isn't it cute?
Yeah.
It doesn't have the same kind of...
gravitas.
No, no, no. Lawrence named it after his admiral in the British Navy, Admiral Edward Vernon. Kind of a fun, ironic fact that George Washington's home is named for a British admiral.
Okay.
You know. So, little side note, Lawrence served under Admiral Vernon in something called... the War of Jenkins' Ear.
I don't think I've ever heard of that.
It's not a real popular thing. Okay. If you had to guess how a war got that name, what would your guess be?
Tell me the name one more time.
The War of Jenkins' Ear.
Is it in the same vein as Van Gogh's ear?
Closer than you might think. Closer than I thought.
So... it sounds like Jenkins got his ear cut off.
Yeah.
During war. Or maybe an ear got cut off and that started a war.
You are better at this than I am.
Whose ear is important enough to start a war over is the question.
That's a great question. I had always assumed that this war was named for some little skirmish that had something to do with like a geographic location somewhere in England.
Mm-hmm.
Like ear... must mean like something like neck of the woods or
totally.
Foot of a hill.
Totally. Like the ear of the corn.
Yes.
Or the ear of the mountain.
Yes, but no.
It's somebody's ear.
It's named after a British captain, Robert Jenkins, who got his ear cut off by a Spanish guy who raided his ship. And as the story goes, Jenkins went to Parliament to testify about this. And he brought his ear with him, pickled in a jar.
That's disgusting.
Right? Right.
I mean, was he hoping to have it sewn back on or?
No, I think it was just like evidence. It's not even super clear if he did bring it with him because there aren't great primary sources, I guess, about this. But this incident played into a whole animosity that already existed and it helped spark a whole war thing in the Caribbean.
Okay. Called Jenkins' Ear War.
The War of Jenkins' Ear.
The War of Jenkins' Ear.
Now, the most...
I mean, I like it better the other way. Jenkins' Ear War.
Jenkins' Ear War does sound kind of... that sounds like something you would buy from, like, an apothecary. If, like, you needed to clear your ears.
What scent is this candle?
Jenkins' Ear War. Is that wax with a typo? No.
My dad got... that baseball field candle for Christmas.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was so bizarre to me. I smelt it, and it really did smell like sweat and dirt. And I wanted nothing to do with that. And I thought it was just so interesting that some people might find that smell comforting.
Yeah, or... your dad hasn't taken it off of his face since he got it, you know? Just
right. So I think Jenkins' Ear War scent... is something maybe we can gift my dad for his birthday.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
There's some folks at, I think it's called JD and Kate Industries.
Okay.
They're not the ones that made that baseball candle. I think that was Home State or something like that. But JD and Kate Industries, they make candles that are like Rutherford B. Hayes candle.
What?
Or the War of 1812. Yeah.
But what does it smell like?
I mean, it smells like what it says, Jess.
But, I know,
you
but how
them liars?
How could they know what 1812 smelled like?
You'll have to look them up and just read more about it.
So here's the War of 1812, and it just smells like shit. It's just pure poop smell, because that's how I imagine it to smell,
maybe
honestly.
Maybe it smells like burning White House?
Sewer and poop.
Wow.
I mean, people were starving and... and running around on cobblestones, do you think they like stopped for the bathroom within a reputable business?
I think
it probably smelled a lot like poop.
There were also flowers growing and food cooking.
I don't think so.
You know, they didn't have flowers back then.
I don't think they were growing.
Wow.
I think the violence probably trampled the flowers, don't you think?
The War of 1812 Scented Candle features a tiny wax White House on its surface. So you can reenact the British Army's burning of the White House. I'm reading this off their website now.
That's disturbing.
Yeah. I'm trying to see, what does it smell
like?
We
are not affiliated with these candles, by the way.
No, we are not.
I feel bad for talking poorly or happily about them, since I really know nothing about
them. Well, I'm not talking poorly about them.
Oh, well, burning White House on the top of the candle?
So you can reenact it at home.
By lighting it.
That's how most candles work.
I would be more interested in a like performance type of reenactment.
That's a lot to ask from a candle. I'm going to be honest.
All right. I don't want that candle.
You didn't want a possum toy either, but look what I got you.
And look what I gave away. No hard feelings. He's just glaring at me.
By the way, Lawrence Washington got tuberculosis during that war, which led to his early death 10 years later. And that's how Mount Vernon ended up going to George.
Wow.
So anyway, it makes sense that LW would stand for George's brother, Lawrence. But it turns out that's probably not the case. When folks really looked at the stone, they realized that its carvings were more like something from the 1600s, well before George's brother owned the place. So now the most likely theory is that LW stands for the name of George's grandfather, which also happens to be Lawrence Washington.
So to a different Lawrence Washington,
if
obviously.
You keep going back in George's heritage, it's like Lawrence after Lawrence.
Okay.
It's a lot of Lawrences. So George's grandfather inherited the property in the 1670s. Back then, you had to seat land to keep your ownership of it. That means you either have to plant crops on it or you have to build a house on it.
You have to build or grow on it.
Yeah, you got to use it. You can't just let it sit.
So you can't sit on it, but you can seat it.
Yeah, you can't just sit. You got to seat or else somebody's going to squat.
Okay.
The consensus seems to be that George's grandfather built a little house on the site to mark his ownership of the land, and that house featured this stone with his initials.
Mm-hmm.
This halberds and heart configuration, as far as I can find, it's pretty unique. This like mix of military power and love. It's like Guns and Roses.
Yeah.
So I don't know. The design, not sure where it came from, might have just been something he thought was cool. And then George came along, saw it, and said, oh, I can't throw this away. Let's put it in the basement where no one will ever see it. Then, more than 200 years later, that design caught the eye of the filmmakers of National Treasure: Book of Secrets. After the script was already written, or I say written, but this is a movie that largely was filmed without a script.
Really?
It was being written as they were filming.
What?
Yeah. Not an ideal way to film a movie, according to the director and everyone involved.
Right.
Not the cheapest way to film a movie.
No.
But they did what they did. But they worked the stone into the movie in a cool way. And there might be some spoilers here for a movie that's, you know, came out 16 years ago. But I promise that these have little to nothing to do with the main plot of the movie. In National Treasure: Book of Secrets, there's a big party sequence that was filmed at Mount Vernon. They filmed it over a couple of weeks in, I think, April of 2007. And they had to film at night because Mount Vernon is open to visitors every day of the year, including Christmas. So they're filming late nights, freezing cold weather, rain, everything that you would want to experience as an extra who shows up wearing your own tuxedo or evening gown. In this scene, Nicolas Cage's character, Ben Gates, Benjamin Franklin Gates, his goal is to get the president alone to ask him about the Book of Secrets from the movie's title. The president is played by Bruce Greenwood, who I have a whole new appreciation for since he played the father in The Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix.
Oh.
Roderick Usher. I mean, that When Life Gives You Lemons speech, like he's so good. He's played the president of the United States three different times. In this movie, and in Kingsman: The Golden Circle, he plays a fictional president, but he played JFK in 13 Days. Wow. You would never know he's actually Canadian. Anyway, Nicolas Cage sneaks into this party at Mount Vernon. It's the president's birthday party, and he approaches the president with a gift. It's a map of Mount Vernon drawn by George Washington himself.
Wow.
And when they show this map, you see a drawing of our little cornerstone on it.
Mm-hmm.
So the president's looking at this map in the movie, and he notices a secret tunnel.
Wow.
In the center. And they're like, oh, man, I wonder if that's still there.
Let's go find it.
Let's go down there during his birthday party.
Uh-huh. Well, that's what I would do.
Right? The Secret Service is like, I don't think. And the president's like, I'll go where I want. So they go down to the cellar. This part wasn't actually filmed at Mount Vernon. They built a cellar set in the studio.
Okay.
Not because Mount Vernon wouldn't let them in the cellar, but because it was just too cramped to get all the equipment and stuff in there.
Right.
But they're in the basement, and they find the stone in the basement, which matches that picture on the map. The stone's a little bit different, though. The prop that they use, it doesn't have a heart in the middle. It's got an arrowhead. And they notice that it's pointed the wrong way. So they turn it, and voila, the wall opens up.
Whoa.
This is literally a pivotal prop in the film.
Yeah.
Literally
pivotal.
Yeah.
It's pivotal.
Yes, literally.
Because it pivots.
It's a very pointed reference.
Oh my God.
According to Karen, the filmmakers changed the prop version of this stone, not just the heart, but they changed the initials LW to GW for George Washington, because that would be easier for the audience to handle.
Right.
According to the story, the team at Mount Vernon saw an early cut of the movie, or they saw it premiere in theaters. And they saw the GW initials
there.
They
said, hell no.
They said, oh, hell no. Yes. Those were not Karen's exact words.
Okay.
But as the story goes, they saw this minor change and they put their foot down and they forced the filmmakers to go back and fix it.
Yeah.
This story stuck in my mind for years. And I always wanted to dig into it because it's like the cherry on top of 150 years of the Mount Vernon Ladies Association fiercely protecting the estate and the legacy of George Washington. And it feels like a little victory for truth and historical accuracy over the soulless, dumbed-down Hollywood machine.
Yeah, the Hollywood, I feel like, yeah, they were going to dumb it down. But I also think, even though it's not a historical film, they should have some, you know, accuracy.
Yeah, yeah.
If they're representing a true site. So I think a little extra line in the movie, like L, might have been Lawrence.
Wait.
Oh, can't wait. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I'm here for it. I'm here.
You are here for it, and it's going to be here for you.
Okay.
But yeah, I know. I love the idea that, like, historians and preservations, they were stepping forward, and they were saying, look, we don't care if you're Disney, if you're Jerry Bruckheimer, we don't care if you're Nicolas Cage, you don't mess with history.
Mm-hmm.
But when I decided to dig into this story a little more, that the filmmakers changed LW to GW, okay, and Mount Vernon made them change it back again, I ran into some issues.
Like?
First off, the only printed source that I found that talks about this, it's an article from the Washington Post in 2008, and it's about how Mount Vernon opened up the cellar for a special National Treasure tour after the movie came out. And it says, movie fans will notice that the initials in the real cornerstone are LW, for Lawrence Washington. This bit of history was too much for Hollywood, so for the movie, a new cornerstone was created with the initials GW.
Mm-hmm.
So this tells me that our tour guide wasn't just making this up, that it came from somewhere.
Right.
But that doesn't have my favorite part of the story, which is Mount Vernon saying, like, oh, no,
right,
and it being changed back.
Is there evidence of that somewhere?
That's what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a podcast that's dedicated to the National Treasure movies and the Disney Plus series. Yes, it's called National Treasure Hunt. It's hosted by Aubrey Paris and Emily Black. They have a blast interviewing people associated with the movies, speculating about them. They did an episode about Mount Vernon with Annette Ahrens, the senior historic interpreter there. She was the guest, and the host asked her about that stone. It came up, and she said, I believe that in the movie version that actually went out in theaters, they put a G instead of an L. But in the DVD version, or the current version you see, they did go back to an actual L. This is the only evidence that's out there of this story, okay, aside from us, like, hearing about it at Mount Vernon. She worked at Mount Vernon at the time of the filming, and she still sounds unsure about what exactly went down. So it's not looking good for this story. Now, I couldn't track down any original prints of the movie that were sent to theaters, partly because I didn't try. But I did find trailers for the movie that were uploaded in 2007 before it premiered in theaters.
Okay.
And those trailers have a shot of the map that shows the stone.
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly has the initials LW. So if there's any truth to this story, it had to have happened before the movie was released.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to know, what's the real story here? What went down between Mount Vernon and the National Treasure Team in the War of Lawrence's Stone? And that brings us to Act Two, my national treasure hunt. Let us tell you about a podcast we think you're gonna love.
Step into the world of Southern Gothic, a narrative history podcast with immersive sound design and in-depth research that brings history to life and uncovers the truth behind classic tales of the paranormal.
Hosted by our good friend Brandon Schecksnyder, Southern Gothic digs into the dark history and infamous legends of the American South.
The podcast covers stories like the Greenbrier Ghost, a West Virginia woman who became the first ghost to help convict her killer in court.
And of course, the Bell Witch of Tennessee, who we covered because of her alleged showdown with Andrew Jackson.
And recently they covered the tragic, haunting story of Theodosia Burr, Aaron Burr's daughter, whose mysterious disappearance at sea led to a ton of rumors and a ton of ghost stories.
Now, if y'all are ready to head on out to the swamp and give Southern Gothic a listen, head over to southerngothicmedia.com/follow for links to all of your favorite podcast apps. That's southerngothicmedia.com/follow.
That is, if you dare.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the Nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Act Two, my national treasure hunt. So, all right, I figured I'd start with the source. I reached out to Mount Vernon's Vice President of Media and Communications, Matt Briney. He wasn't there in 2007 when they filmed the movie, but he was just as enthusiastic about getting down to the bottom of the story. Because he said, as far as anyone there knows, the story that I heard, the story that Annette told on the National Treasure Hunt podcast, it's true, it matches what they all know, but he couldn't verify it or provide any more details about what exactly was changed or when or how. So he's like, hey, let me know what you uncover and send me a digital copy for our archives. Okay, all right. Matt told me that their point person for the location shoot, the person who dealt with the filmmakers more than anybody, was a woman named Nancy Hayward. She's no longer at Mount Vernon, and I was told that she's in poor health. But I said, I don't care. I need answers.
Oh my gosh, you did not.
No, I did not. I did absolutely not do that.
Okay.
But he did ask someone who knows her to run this by her, which was very kind. And she got back to him. She said that she remembers the initials did switch back and forth, but she couldn't recall any details. She said the person who would most likely have been dealing with the filmmakers on the whole authenticity of what they were filming was a man named Jim Reese.
This is a lot of people.
Oh, it's a lot of people.
You went through.
I went through, yes. But this man, Jim Reese, he's the former president and CEO of Mount Vernon. If anybody there would know the real story behind this prop, it would be him. Sadly, he passed away in 2014. I'm told that he was a stickler for accuracy.
Yeah.
That makes him sound kind of like a stick in the mud. But I don't think so, because I found a clip from the Ali G show. Did you ever watch that?
No.
HBO show with Sacha Baron Cohen, who's Borat. Mm-hmm. He's also a character named Ali G, that would basically be these wacky people interviewing people.
Mm-hmm.
he's interviewing Jim Reese at Mount Vernon, and Jim came off as like a great sport, the perfect straight man, just rolling with it when Ali G asked him if Denzel Washington still lives there, if Washington did a lot of jet skiing on the Potomac. He doesn't seem like someone who would pressure a studio to fix a prop like this.
Right, okay.
But I can't be sure. But I do know that the folks at Mount Vernon can be very serious when it comes to preservation and authenticity. Mm-hmm. For example, one time, an architectural curator there, Mark A. LeFrancois, resigned in protest over the installation of air conditioning in the mansion.
Oh my goodness.
In 1998.
Oh my gosh.
When Nate Bargatze would say that that was a time when air conditioning was doing real good.
Yeah, it's not like a new concept.
No, and it was a major careful operation. They used the same company that installed air conditioning in the Sistine Chapel. But
wow,
some people couldn't stomach that.
Oh my gosh.
So it's not crazy to think that someone might make a lot of noise about a historic artifact being portrayed incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
But no one at Mount Vernon seemed to have the answers that I was looking for. So maybe the people behind National Treasure Book of Secrets would.
Oh my gosh.
So I went all the way to the top.
All the way to Hollywood.
I tracked down Nicolas Cage.
Are you kidding me?
No, I did not track down Nicolas Cage, but through a friend in the business, I was actually put in touch with the director of the movie, John Turteltaub.
Okay.
This man has the coolest resume. I mean, there's National Treasure 1 and 2, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also the man responsible for Cool Runnings.
Oh, really?
While You Were Sleeping.
Oh.
Phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
Three Ninjas. And The Meg.
Oh, fun.
So he's worked with John Travolta and Nicolas Cage separately.
And together.
With their faces on, just separately. He did not do Face Off. He did Faces On, separate movies.
Got it.
But he's directed.
What was John Travolta in that he did?
Phenomenon.
Oh, Phenomenon. Yeah, I like that movie.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, he's directed Sandra Bullock, Ninjas, and A Giant Shark. And if the combination of any three things could prepare someone to take on the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, I think it's those three things.
Yeah, right? He's well prepared.
Yes. So a friend sent my question about this prop to someone who sent it on to him, and one day later, he responded.
Wow.
Hey, Howard, he said. That's me.
Okay, yeah, that's you, but who's writing directly to you?
John Turteltaub.
Oh, he wrote directly to you?
He wrote directly to
me. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Nice. That's a nice thing to do.
It is. It is. And he said, I love this question. It's so great to know that somebody was paying attention to the shit we do to make things right. Yeah. So already this was much better than the answer I was expecting, which was simply unsubscribe. Director John Turteltaub, he had great things to say about the folks at Mount Vernon, how they were very helpful, just like curators at lots of other places. I guess that experts at these places helped them take things out of the script that didn't make sense and showed them things that they thought were cool and could put into the movie.
That's really cool.
Which is great if you don't really have a script yet. They can show you
really helpful
what you should put in the movie. It's like, hey, why don't you write about this?
Yeah.
Like the cellar at Mount Vernon.
Yeah.
By the way, this really makes me want to be a filmmaker, at least pretend to be one, so I can go to these historic places and be like, hey, show me your cool stuff.
Yeah, show me your cellar, man.
Right? Right. On the subject of the cornerstone prop,
uh-huh.
John Turteltaub told me that he absolutely remembered the conversation about Lawrence Washington.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Finally.
I was like, yes! But then he said that this was like 16, 17 years ago and some stuff is fuzzy. Okay. Right?
Right.
To the best of his memory, there might have been a version of the script that said GW instead of LW. And the people at Mount Vernon may have pointed out that it should be LW.
Right.
Now, if that's the case, it is the least dramatic way that this could have gone down.
I was going to say that's a lot less dramatic than one of the stories.
Yes, it sounds like there was no fight.
Right.
And he said that when they pointed that out, he said, for most movie makers, that kind of thing is really annoying. For us, that stuff was gold.
Right.
Because in making these movies, they really loved finding these real historical things that they could then sort of twist or explain in a cool way.
Build upon.
Yes. Because like he said earlier, he cares about getting things right. He also said that he doesn't think they would have remade the actual metal stone because it was tricky and it had an arrow on it that had to move. And he said replacing it would have cost money, which is a great obstacle to accuracy.
Mm.
That's my motto.
Yeah. Yes. That's another like big Hollywood versus history.
Yeah,
moment.
Definitely. Definitely. he did say that he vaguely remembers in an early cut of the movie, and you kind of talked about this, mm-hmm. that there was dialogue about why the stone said LW instead of GW,
mm-hmm.
like explaining who Lawrence was. But he said, when the first cut of a movie is 4 hours long, exposition like this hits the cutting room floor pretty quickly.
Got it. Okay.
And that makes sense.
Yeah.
This is an exciting scene where Nicolas Cage is about to kidnap the president. So it's a weird time to start talking about George Washington's extended family.
Right. That makes sense.
Yes. That's probably why. Instead, there's an awkward line that Nicolas Cage's character says about this plaque. You don't even see him say it, so it could have been like ADR recorded later. He says, it's the mark of George Washington,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't make any sense. The stone was engraved 50 years before George Washington was born. It doesn't have his initials on it, but I get that you've got to say something to acknowledge this confusing but historically accurate prop you've built that's been turned into a lever to open a secret passage.
Right.
So that's what they ended up saying.
Okay.
Now, I'd love to see like a 10-minute talk about like, hey, this is Ella for Lawrence Washington. Actually, it's the grand. No, it's not.
It doesn't need to be 10 minutes. But why does it say L? Because that was his cousin.
I'm already bored. I'm out.
It was his cousin.
I mean,
that's what like Indiana Jones.
So
do you
boring.
Remember? Do you remember Indiana Jones like went into that stuff? This is the shield. The shield, like rubbings when he went to the blah blah blah.
A little bit.
It was really cool.
Yeah.
It makes it less fluffy and more edgy.
Edgy. Okay. Edgy.
Historical.
So you're saying Indiana Jones is more historical and edgy? Even though
no
Indiana Jones,
I'm not
has
saying it's accurate.
Supernatural elements protecting these
First
treasures.
Of all, I'm focusing. Okay, I'm not saying Indiana Jones is a historical film.
No,
no.
Okay, but it is the same sort of treasure hunting genre.
Treasure hunting genre, where details about the meaning of an artifact is described,
right,
in the moment of finding it.
I mean, I feel like the stuff Indiana Jones just made up. So
okay,
when they justify
I get that
things,
you and
it's like for a different reason.
I get that you and Turtle Dove are like BFFs now.
Hey, you don't talk that way about John.
What's his name?
Turtletob. John Turtletob.
Turtletob. I get that you and Turtletob are BFFs now, but I'm just saying, I think it would have been an okay line. I also get that we are not film experts, and therefore the fact that
wrong.
It probably would have been edited out anyway, is, you know, I'm going to trust him to make those decisions. That's why I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Also, whatever explanation for it was written was probably written moments before it was filmed, so may not have been the most concise, easy to keep kind of thing. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's what the director of the National Treasure Films recalls, but I can't help thinking that there's more. And neither can he, because he left me with this. He said, but rattling around in my brain somewhere is a conversation about Lawrence Washington and the LW. The answer is out there in an early script or an early cut, but I don't have it handy and I'm too lazy to find out.
Okay.
And you know what? I don't mind sharing that because
we all feel that way sometimes.
Yes. I love
priorities.
I love that he said that because it's refreshingly honest. And it's like, I would like to help you further, but that's beyond the level of effort that this esoteric question deserves.
Right. I mean, it's fair enough.
It is fair. And he's super passionate about these projects. He's passionate about like National Treasure 3 happening and all this stuff.
Really?
Like, yes. So he's got a lot of love for these movies and for historical accuracy. But that little bit, it just can't get there.
That's all he just, that's all he could get.
He's not going in his own cellar to look through old versions to find that answer.
That's okay.
So I was afraid that this was the end of the story. But then
there's more.
I heard from one more person who worked on the film. Because I reached out to a lot of people.
Yeah, sounds
good. I was looking at IMDb, looking at LinkedIn. Like,
oh my gosh.
I apologize to all the people who have random messages for me. But the last person that I heard from seems to have a better memory of the filming than anyone else I've talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's prop man Ross McDonald. Ross McDonald created the titular Book of Secrets from the film titled National Treasure Book of Secrets. He's worked on something like 150 productions. So when you need an old map or a document for a movie that needs to look authentic and awesome, you call Ross McDonald.
Oh, cool.
He has a barn full of 19th century printing and bookbinding tools. His stuff that he makes looks amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, it sounds like the moving stone prop or metal plaque or whatever they used in the movie, that's not Ross McDonald's forte.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't involved in that prop. But like I said earlier, that stone and the initials on it are shown multiple times on another prop, the map of Mount Vernon, that was said to have been drawn by George Washington. That was Ross McDonald's creation. And he writes about his experiences on the film in his book, Prop Man, which is pretty great.
Oh, awesome.
Let me show you.
Oh,
a little bit.
I love it when you pull books out of nowhere.
Right?
It's a cute book.
Yeah. All right. So here, I mean, there's a lot of beautiful pictures in that book, but that's an example of the Mount Vernon map. Mm-hmm. You can see the stone. You can see the LW.
Yeah.
From what he writes, it's clear what a mad dash this movie was. He talks about how the script was the last thing to be nailed down. He was hired to write a book of secrets, and he asked what should be in it. And they said, we don't know. Just make it. And he came up with lots of ideas. Eventually, a cool one that was sort of an old leather diary type book that's bound with a leather strap. That strap is actually a shoelace from a 100-year-old boot that he found in a barn.
Oh, wow.
That detail is not important, but it's the kind of stuff I love. I also love that he talks about how he's on set for this stuff. He's finding out new things he has to make. He's ordering room service in his hotel with coffee so that he can coffee stain paper in the hotel sink for a prop that's needed that day. And I just love that.
Yeah, that's you for sure. Maybe you should be a prop maker.
This is if...
In addition to a podcaster and a project manager.
If I were to start over...
Why not have three jobs?
You know, if I were to start over, this might be something I'd explore.
I can see that. Because you like to tea stain your own letters.
I do.
Yeah.
Why
you
not?
Make your own props.
Hey.
Just naturally.
All this time, I could have been getting paid. But it sounds like a tough gig. It really does. But Ross and his map, from the beginning, every version that he drew always had the initials LW. So if there was any discussion about Hollywood trying to dumb down this prop, it must have happened well before anything was filmed. I would say at the script stage, but it sounds like that was happening at the same time as the filming. So maybe there was a conversation where someone suggested they might change the prop version of the stone. And curator Jim Reese either said, I wish you wouldn't, or please don't. Or maybe he said, you know what, do whatever you want, because we'll make a nice story out of it on the tours we give when ticket sales to Mount Vernon triple after the movie comes out.
Right.
So Ross showed me other early versions and the final version of the map that he used in the movie. Everything had LW. But it doesn't totally eliminate the possibility that a temporary change was made that he wasn't aware of, because he said that he was called out to Mount Vernon right after he was working for weeks on the film in D.C. He just flew home, but they called him back and they said, hey, we need you on site at Mount Vernon to do some stuff on the map. But he said he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
He's like, I can't bring myself to do this. My family misses me.
Yeah, I just got home.
Exactly. So he found someone else, a local artist, to step in for the night. Apparently, this illustrator was really excited to be in a movie, but the next day when Ross asked him about it, he said it was a horrible experience, and it sounds like they had him redrawing that map over and over again.
I don't know.
The thing is, Ross can't for the life of him remember who that guy was.
Huh.
The story is retold in his book, Prop Man, but the book actually names the artist. So I thought, oh man, okay, I'm going to reach out to this guy on the off chance that at one point they said, hey, draw a version of that stone with a GW. I figured I'd reach out to him. I found him, John Kachick, asked him about it. He got back to me and he told me that I must have the wrong guy. He didn't know what I was talking about. The only movie he'd ever worked on was Major League 2.
Okay. So, wrong guy then, huh?
So I went back to Ross. And Ross was like, oh man, I think somebody, not him, guessed that the artist who did that one day gig was John Kachick. And that
put
was
it in
enough,
the book.
Good enough for the book editor. Yes. Ross still has no idea who that guy was. And that might be the person that was most closely involved with the only prop on set at Mount Vernon to feature this cornerstone. And it's a prop that we know was drawn and redrawn that night. We just can't find the person.
Wow. Mystery person. Mystery prop man.
Yes. So for
all... Or woman.
I think he said it was a guy. I think he talked to him. He knew that much.
Mystery prop man.
Yeah. So for all I know, this plucky artist showed up on set at Mount Vernon that night and loudly said, hey, what's with the initials LW? Let's just change it to GW, hey?
Hey.
And the next morning, curator Jim Reese said, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And then this artist was never seen again.
Or heard from.
Right.
His name was erased.
He could be at the bottom of the Potomac right now.
Wow.
Whatever happened, I think it's safe to say that there was no theatrical version of National Treasure Book of Secrets with a G for George instead of an L for Lawrence.
We just don't have the evidence.
No. The story that's become a legend, that's told on tours, it just isn't true. whatever events that led to the War of Lawrence's Stone were overblown, and the truth is lost to time or just simply not worth the effort to dig up.
Which is fair.
Yes. I'm prepared to lay this mystery down for now.
Yeah.
But if anyone out there listening can shed more light on where this story came from, or if you are the local DC artist who still has nightmares about the cold night you spent in 2007 redrawing a map at Mount Vernon, please reach out. I want to know that you're okay. But most of all, I want to know the truth. So I'm going to let Annette Ahrens have the last word. On the National Treasure Hunt podcast, when she was talking about how they only recently discovered that the LW stands for George's grandfather and not his brother, she got excited about making new discoveries and uncovering hidden truths. And she said, I like to say, history is not written in stone.
Uh-huh. Perfection.
And that concludes our series on Mount Vernon.
Oh, wow. That was a long one. So I feel like I have so much information about that place.
Right?
I know all about it now.
We got to go back.
Now we need to visit.
Yes. And we'll go on a tour and the tour guide will start talking and we'll be like, hey, no.
There's no evidence for that.
And then the rest of the people on the tour will be like,
We want our money back.
This is terrible. Make those people shut up.
They're really going to hate us.
They might.
I might just slowly step aside and let you handle that.
I think they might all step aside and close the cellar door.
And then we'll live in the cellar.
Yes, I'll be that guy.
The cellar guy.
Yeah. Mount Vernon still gives the National Treasure Tour.
I like how you're excited about that, being that guy.
Yeah.
The cellar guy.
I'm the cellar
guy.
You're
like, yeah, lock me in the cellar. I want to be a prisoner of the cellar. Yeah. Like that, you were excited.
They keep like salt and stuff in there. I don't know. I'll be fine.
So you'll be fine.
I'll be fine.
Just roll yourself in salt and you'll be nicely preserved.
They give frequent tours, so there will be people there that I can, I don't know.
They'll open the door and be like, help, it was never a G. And they'll close it on you again.
Don't listen to them. Lies. They still give the tour. But before you go, check on mountvernon.org if you want to see that cellar because it might be inaccessible due to preservation work.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But even if you can't get in there, there's a lot to see.
There is so much to see. Yeah.
One correction I want to call out from our earlier Mount Vernon episodes. We talked about sitting in the rocking chairs on George Washington's piazza. I was reminded that the chairs aren't actually rocking chairs. They're just regular chairs.
Oh.
Yes.
It's important.
But I maintain that any chair can be a rocking chair if you try hard enough.
That's a really important correction. I want people to have the right image painted in their head of us growing old together on that porch.
Yes, yes. And I'm not going to pretend that there weren't other things that weren't perfect in those episodes, but this is the one thing I cared about correcting.
Got it.
Our next episode takes us far from Mount Vernon, but still close to Hollywood.
Nice.
I am so excited to be interviewing Kirk Ellis, one of the screenwriters of Apple TV's Franklin miniseries. He's also the screenwriter of the incredible HBO miniseries John Adams.
Oh, I'm so excited to hear from him.
Yes, I can't wait to talk to him about his experiences adapting those stories for the screen.
I'm very excited that he'll be on the pod.
Yes. If you like what you heard, spread the word. Follow, subscribe, tell your acquaintances. Consider joining our Patreon family for some fun extras. You can find a link to that and more at our website, plodpod.com. This has been an Airwave Media podcast. Thank you for plotting along with us.
Thanks for plotting. Bye. But what does it smell like?